upside down while playing. John was in one of his moods. I don't know if he was secretly terrified to go out there and have that kind of responsibility, or if there was just so much energy going on that maybe it was too much for him to be comfortable facing, but he was very moody and very distant. He played well, but there wasn't a lot of interconnectedness happening among us. For the finale, we donned the socks, an event that was becoming rarer and rarer. The next show was in Del Mar, a town just north of San Diego. We played a giant airplane hangar of a room, and once again, Nirvana went out and destroyed with their set, and the kids went insane. It was so packed in there by the time we came on stage that steam had risen off the audience and formed a discernible cloud. We played better that night. There was less pressure, for one, and John felt like rocking a bit more. Maybe Nirvana was pushing him. That night was the beginning of my ongoing battle with tinnitus. Chad and I both came off stage and hugged backstage and realized that our ears were perceptibly ringing. By the end of that tour, I'd have permanent ear damage, which, unfortunately, is one of the hardest things to cure. Our next gig was in San Francisco, at the Cow Palace, for a big New Year's Eve bash. We stayed at the Phoenix Hotel, which was a glorified motel in a scurvy neighborhood. After the show, I rang in the new year by sitting poolside with Kurt and Courtney. We sat there for about an hour under the stars, just talking, having a bonding session. Kurt was the most relaxed I'd ever see him, and probably the straightest, too. By the time we hit Salem, Oregon, my vocal cords were shot. They were like two fat sausages smushed into each other, and I couldn't make a sound. So we had to reschedule the last few dates of the West Coast tour. After a short break, it was time to tour Europe. John was not only continuing to distance himself from the joy of being in the band, he had started losing the battle of psychic wellness. He went through a period when he was convinced that someone, our driver, the hotel bellman, whoever, was trying to kill him every day. I'm pretty sure he believed it, so we had this constant struggle of having to convince him that no one was trying to kill him. "Well, I don't know," he'd say. "I saw our driver talking to someone in the street, and I think that someone is connected with the people who want me dead." I think John was experiencing good old-fashioned weed paranoia taken to an extreme. He was smoking shitloads of weed and drinking gallons of wine, not wanting to be on tour, but finding himself there. Traveling was no longer jovial. We wouldn't get on the bus and sing and listen to music together and talk about the day's events and have little competitions. The bus became a dark and unwelcoming place, because we had divided into camps. John had broken our unwritten rule of no spouses or girlfriends on the road. It wasn't a great thing for us that Tony was on tour, because it allowed John to further insulate himself. A lot of people compared their relationship to John and Yoko, but that wasn't accurate. Tony would never think of speaking for John. She was there to coddle him and support his decisions. Even in the face of tension, she would smile placidly. So I never thought she was coming between John and the band. It was clearly John's doing, and she was tagging along. Things deteriorated to the point where John and I didn't talk on the bus, and if we ran into each other in passing, we wouldn't even acknowledge each other. That was a pretty unbearable place to be, and I didn't have a palette of spiritual principles to choose from to help me deal with all the madness. I became sad and angry and resentful and poisoned by the whole experience. I was being an asshole. John was being an asshole, and poor Flea was hiding under the covers, unable to deal with it at all. Even Lindy, who had always been the mediator, was at a total loss. He had been getting frantic calls from John's mom and dad, begging him to help John, because he seemed to be in so much trouble. But Lindy was as stupefied and paralyzed by the situation as anyone else. No one was being proactive. We didn't stop to assess the whole situation. We just tried to get through it from week to week, which didn't create a healing environment. Considering the severity of the dysfunction being displayed, it's strange for me to look back and think that we didn't realize things couldn't go on like this. It got worse before it got better. We interrupted our European tour to fly into New York City near the end of February to do Saturday Night Live, which was a disaster from beginning to end. We weren't there for 5 minutes before John started fighting with the staff. The music supervisor, a guy who'd been up there for years, came over and made an innocuous remark to John, and John turned his back on him and told Louis, "This guy says another word to me, I'm not doing the fucking show." I was already apprehensive because we were planning to do Under the Bridge as our second number, and that song always was a challenge for me to sing. I was entirely dependent on John for the musical cue into the song. And when we did the dress rehearsal, he was playing something in a different key, out of tune, in a different timing, basically reinventing the song for himself and nobody else. I was flummoxed. We retreated into our dressing room and tried to hash it out, but there was no talking to him. He'd find Tony and go into another room. But he was in the dressing room long enough to feel dissed when Madonna came by to visit. She was going to be in one of the skits that night, so she came by to say hello. I had known her for years and years, going back to her holiday video, when she wanted to cast me if I would agree to change my hairstyle, which I didn't. The whole time she was back there, she inadvertently ignored John, and he stormed out, irate that she had given him no love and no props. The show began, and we did our first number, Stone Cold Bush, an up-tempo rocker. It went well. Then we came back to do Under the Bridge. I've since heard that John was on heroin during this show, but he might as well have been on another planet, because he started playing some shit I had never heard before. I had no idea what song he was playing or what key he was in. He looked like he was in a different world. To this day, John denies that he was playing off-key. According to him, he was experimenting, the way he would have if we'd been rehearsing the tune. Well, we weren't. We were on live TV in front of millions of people, and it was torture. I started to sing in what I thought was the key, even if it wasn't the key he was playing in. I felt like I was getting stabbed in the back and hung out to dry in front of all of America, while this guy was off in a corner in the shadow, playing some dissonant, out-of-tune experiment. I thought he was doing that on purpose, just to fuck with me. We got through the song, and it sounded like four different people playing four different songs. At the time, I was dating Sofia Coppola, another one of my unfulfilled attempts at a relationship during this period of my life. She was by far the coolest girl I had gone out with, especially in that period after Carmen, and I told her to make sure to watch the show, and now I was just fucking dying. When something happens like that, it's like the kicker who misses a field goal as the clock is running out. The only thing that's going to take away that pain is playing another game and getting another chance to kick the field goal. The pain was there for a long time, because we went back to Europe, and John's behavior got even more erratic. When it came time for him to solo, he would pull the cord out of his guitar and create a jarring noise, and then plug it back in, and if he felt like it, play the chorus. The ironic part about Saturday Night Live was, the week after our performance, our record went through the roof. Maybe it was just a coincidence, but maybe people heard something in that chaotic performance that touched them. After we finished the European leg of the tour, we went back home and had a couple of weeks off before going to Hawaii, Japan, and Australia. When we came home between legs of tours, I saw less of Flea, and I never saw much of Chad. John disappeared and started pursuing his drug use. So I'd hang out with whatever girl I was seeing at the time, although I was mainly doing the random dating thing, and nothing was sticking. Since my split with John, I had room in my life for a new running partner, and I found one in Jimmy Boyle. He was a friend of Rick Rubin, who looked exactly like Rasputin, with a full beard and mustache and long Jesus hair and crazy psycho blue eyes, and he dressed like an elegant ragman. The more we saw each other, the more we realized the many things we had in common. He was a recovering drug addict who had just gotten divorced from a tragic, young, beautiful dope fiend whom I dated as well. He was also a vegetarian, a practice I had picked up from Ione. He loved music, and he loved chasing girls. Every day I was in town, we'd meet for a ritualistic breakfast of blueberry pancakes at a Votre Sante on La Brea. I invited Jimmy to come to Hawaii with us. He loved it because he loved to be around the excitement of music, not to mention the girls. Plus, we were going to Hawaii, for Christ's sake. John was still being distant while we were in Hawaii. Our record had been doing okay, better than any of our previous ones, though still only okay, barely in the top 40. Once we were in Hawaii, we got a call from Lindy. "Guys, I don't know what to tell you, but this record is going through the roof. It's charting next week at number 8, he told us. For me, that was cause for celebration. Flea was feeling the same way, but John was staying removed from the whole thing. That whole trip was teeming with hot young Hawaiian girls, and it was a fun time for all, because everyone was feeling full of life and the sunshine and the ocean. Boyle and I were sharing a room, and at 4 in the morning, we were asleep when there was a knock on the door. I went to answer, and it was this young Hawaiian maiden. "Can I come in?" she asked. "Well, my friend's sleeping. It's not really a good idea. It's 4 in the morning, I reminded her. "Really? I can't come in?" she pressed. It's kind of an uncomfortable situation." Right there, in the hallway of this hotel, she dropped to her knees and gave me a blowjob. Jimmy was so jealous. "I can't believe this. You fucking hear a knock in the middle of the night, you go to the doorway, and the most beautiful girl on the island gets down on her knees and gives you a blowjob? What is that? What have I done wrong in my lifetime not to deserve this kind of treatment?" I wasn't overjoyed about all this new adulation I was getting. I wasn't having the same reaction John was, but on a personal level, I wasn't letting it all go to my head. I think I didn't feel entitled now that I was becoming famous, and I stayed relatively humble. That was my perception, and I'm sure somebody else had a different take. I recognize when I feel a sense of entitlement. You get used to having things your way, but I also recognize the absurdity of that, and I'm willing to laugh at myself and to acknowledge when I'm being a spoiled brat and when I'm not. I found it fascinating and peculiar more than suddenly thinking I was better than or holier than. It's ironic because on most days, Flea is the biggest spoiled brat in the band. But he and I had this talk in Santa Monica, and he said, "You know, Anthony, this record is doing so good. I think you're becoming a bit of an egomaniac." "Me? Me? You're the egomaniac. Take a look at your own ego," I proposed. I'm sure there was some bloated ego thing happening that I wasn't able to recognize, but I didn't feel like it would last for long. The weird thing is that long before we ever had success on a commercial level, I had already developed a sense of entitlement. I had an unnecessary, unwarranted, unfounded, self-centered sense of entitlement from childhood. In elementary school, I always felt like I should be the president of the school, and that I was somehow above the law of the school, and I could break the rules. When I moved in with my father, he was arrogant and full of himself, and that carried on to me. So I always had this sense of entitlement and a semi-false sense of self. I would steal because I had that sense, whether it was houses or cars or furniture or cactuses, whatever. I understand how people can be cold and ruthless criminals, because I remember at that point in my life, I did not think about the consequences for anybody else involved except me. And the consequences for me were that I got what I wanted. The richer and more famous I got, the less I behave in that manner. Sure, the ego does get inflated and retarded and grotesque in some ways, but that's a chance to learn. A chance to go, okay, what do I have to do to deal with this weirdness, and how do I diminish the ego to a point where it's not interfering with my relating to the rest of the universe? If anything, everything was making me less selfish and less self-centered, and more interested in getting out of myself and being in a place where I could share. A lot of times people will judge you on their perceived idea of how you're acting. If you're in a room and you're feeling shy and you don't want a certain amount of attention, you're not going out of your way to make friends with everybody. Then someone's going to walk away going, "That arrogant motherfucker, he didn't even try to talk to me." You're trying to lay low and not make a big deal about yourself, but they're seeing you as this guy who's all that in a bag of fucking chips. I don't feel like I started thinking of myself any differently while this was happening. If anything, I was thinking of myself in a worse light, because I'd lost an important connection in my life with John. I began realizing that I'd been carrying on as a control freak, wanting to have everything go according to my plans, which turned out to be the biggest pain in the ass ever. I used to think that everything would be great if Flea just behaved this way and John did what I wanted him to do, and that was probably the biggest mistake I made during that time, thinking that I knew better or had a plan, and if everyone followed it, things would be peachy. That was a recipe for misery and ruin. Once I recognized all that, the brotherhood of our band had once more been compromised beyond repair. We hit Japan in early May 1992. It's strange, because John thought we had worked out our differences by then, but I still felt that we weren't close. He was still in his cocoon with Tony, and he was again exhibiting some strange behavior. The night before our Tokyo gig, John was in the lobby of our hotel with Louis, and became convinced that he had exposed himself to some female autograph seekers, and that he was in imminent danger of getting arrested and deported. There was a distinctly erratic, unpredictable vibe happening around John. He was smoked out of his mind, and also hitting the wine in such a way that he didn't strike me as being typically drunk. I don't know if it was a combination of the wine and the pot, but it seemed like he was drinking psycho juice rather than just wine. There was the typical dopey, daffy, wobbly, slurry, normal drunk behavior, but there was also this weird PCP-like drunk going on, like he was in a different space. The next morning, John traveled to the venue with the crew. Lindy and Flea and Chad and I came on a later train, and when we got to the arena, Mark Johnson told us that John had quit the band and he wanted to go home immediately. Mind you, we were slated to go to Australia after Japan, and it would be our first Australian tour ever. This was incredibly important to us because it was a land that we loved. It was the birthplace of Flea. It was the new land of milk and honey and sunshine and girls, just a magical place. So there was panic in Lindy's eyes and in Flea's and my hearts. We had to talk to John right away, even though the final die had been cast. We went back into the room where John was holed up. "I have to leave the band. I have to quit. I have to go home right away. I can't do this anymore," he told me. "I will die if I don't get out of this band right away." I saw the look in his eyes, and I knew there was no other choice. There was no point in even trying to talk him into staying. A huge sense of relief came over me. The last thing in the world I ever would want to happen was happening. But thank God he was walking away. Because as much as this was going to hurt, the relief of not having to deal with the drama on a day-to-day basis would be greater than the self-imposed pain and suffering. Lindy was concerned with the sold-out venue. Finally, we got John to agree to play the show before he got on the plane to go home. It was the most horrible show ever. Every single note, every single word hurt, knowing that we were no longer a band. I kept looking over at John and seeing this dead statue of disdain. In some ways, I wish we would have canceled the show and returned everyone's money rather than having them witness this display of twisted energy. And that night, John disappeared from the topsy-turvy world of the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Chapter 11. Warped. While we were still in Japan, we came up with a plan. We would go on to Australia, where we'd meet up with our friend Xander Schloss, who was going to take John's place. Xander was a talented guitar player who could read and write music, a quick study with a zany, soulful, comic sensibility. We had 7 days to teach him enough songs to rock out Australia. Xander met us in Sydney, and we started intensive two-a-day rehearsals. But after 4 days, it was clear to Flea and me that this wasn't happening. Xander was playing the songs, but it didn't feel like the Red Hot Chili Peppers. At that point, we decided we'd rather cancel the dates than present a half-assed version of ourselves. When we told Xander, he was devastated. "You'd have thought he was in the band for 4 years instead of 4 days. Oh my God, I just went from having the richest, most incredible future to not only being where I started from, but being 8,000 miles from home," Xander said. "Am I going to get a ticket back?" We assured him we weren't going to strand him, and we all stayed in Australia for a few more days and enjoyed the gorgeous weather and the beautiful girls. I was friendly with Greer Gavorko, a New Zealander who was one of our crew members. When he showed me pictures from a recent trip he'd taken to Thailand, I thought, I'm in Australia, which is nowhere near Hollywood. I have no idea what's going to happen to my future, because now we're limping through life as a band. My left nut, in the person of John Frusciante, has just departed my testicle sac. So why don't I just go to Thailand by myself? Greer recommended some islands in the Gulf of Siam. So I flew to Bangkok, stayed the night in a hotel airport, and then flew to the south and got on a boat to Koh Samui. It was a beautiful island, and the weather was incredible, but the place was teeming with Euro-trash party animals. It was coke, bad music, and half-naked beautiful women all high on ecstasy. I hadn't come to Thailand to immerse myself in a techno-fantasy world, so I traveled to the next island, Koh Phangan. It was a little more laid-back and beautiful, but I was still discontented, so I got a recommendation from some Thai natives to go to Koh Tao, a small island with no hotels. Koh Tao was exactly what I had been dreaming of. I rented a little house from a Thai family and stayed for a week, going scuba diving every day. I left the island feeling recharged and cleansed, and more prepared to deal with John being gone. As soon as I got back, Flea and I went to the drawing board. We were familiar with an L.A. band called Martial Law, which consisted of two brothers, Lonnie Marshall on bass and Eric Marshall on guitar. Both of these guys were funky, freaky, oddball prodigies on their instruments. They were from South Central, and they were half black and half Jewish, the old bluish thing. I had seen them a number of times, and Eric's guitar playing, especially, had blown me away. It was funky, but also hard-rocking and inventive. We auditioned a few other people, including this guy called Buckethead, who would play his whole set with a Kentucky Fried Chicken bucket on his head while encased in a chicken coop. When Eric jammed with us, it was fun and inspiring, so we ended up hiring him, and he was thrust into the insanity of our world. Even though we had just lost John, who was such a fundamental element of our huge success with Blood Sugar, the promoters and MTV and the whole music industry didn't perceive us as being finished, because nothing was stopping. We were offered to headline Lollapalooza, the biggest tour in America that summer. Lindy had booked some huge European festivals for us in June as well. Luckily for us, Eric was an incredibly fast study. He could hear a song on the radio, and within 60 seconds, play it with the same vibe and spirit of the original. But going to Belgium a few weeks into his tenure in the Chili Peppers, before 70,000 people, was truly a baptism by fire. He was petrified. Eric had hardly ever left L.A. County, and now he was in an exotic country in Northern Europe where they speak three languages. Eric was extremely introverted, so he dealt with all this pressure by sleeping. The motherfucker would sleep all day and all night, then get in the van on the way to the show and sleep some more. But he never let us down in concert. He just stood up there and played his ass off. Headlining Lollapalooza was a pretty big-ass deal for us. It was the second year of that festival, and the idea of traveling across the country with a bunch of like-minded maniacs appealed to us. Anytime you're a part of a festival, the pressure is cut in half. Even if you're the headliner, you don't have to carry the weight of the whole show. Since this was a tough time in the life of our band, thank God the shows were not all about us. Plus, you get to meet some interesting performers whom you might never encounter if not for this. I was never a fan of Ministry, but they wound up blowing me away every night. I didn't know how they could be so fucked up on booze and heroin and coke and whippets and go out there and crush it. After a few shows into the tour, everybody started jamming with everybody else. Ice Cube was rocking the house, and Flea and I used to go on stage for a song. We danced, happy to be a part of his flag-waving posse. Then he joined us on Higher Ground. Eddie Vedder, who was there with Pearl Jam, would sing backup for Soundgarden, but in keeping with his humble servant-of-the-music attitude, he'd stand way off by the back of the stage. Chad played drums on one of Ministry's songs. The whole show was a love fest, except for the Jesus and Mary Chain, this British group, who were just bitter. They'd polish off a giant bottle of booze by 2 in the afternoon and curse and put everyone down. One time, they went too far with the guys from Ice Cube's band, and they got themselves a beating. I bonded with these giant gangster Samoans called the Booyah Tribe, who were playing on the secondary stage. I was enthralled, listening to their stories of gang warfare in East L.A. They told me that their friends would get shot and not even know it because they were so big, so they'd walk around for a couple of days with bullets in them. By the end of the tour, I got one of the Booyah guys to come on stage during Higher Ground, and he put out his arm, picked me up, and perched me on his forearm. I rocked the whole song, sitting like a puppet on his arm. We added some special elements for our Lollapalooza shows. We built a giant psychedelic Twilight Zone-looking spiraling wheel that we placed in the center of the stage for hypnotic purposes. But the ultimate touch was the fire helmets that we wore for our encore. Whenever I think of performing, fire comes to my mind. It's such a visual thing, and it goes so well with music. I wasn't thinking in the grand pyrotechnical arena of bands like Kiss or The Who. I just thought it would be great if we wore helmets that belched fire. So we went to a prop designer Lindy knew, and he came up with a silver construction helmet that had a spigot sticking out of the top and a tube that ran from the spigot to a can of propane housed on a waist belt. We each had a valve at our side so we could control the intensity of the flame. But when you're dealing with fire and a delivery system, there are bound to be some screw-ups. We'd be able to spew out a good 3-foot plume of fire, but on some nights, someone wouldn't hit the valve right, or the propane can would be nearly empty, and there'd be three guys with raging volcano heads and one guy with a 3-inch Bic lighter coming out of his head. Only he had no idea his flame was so small. It was very emasculating. Flame envy. At several venues, fire marshals tried to stop the show. Lindy used to have to carry extra cash, and when the marshal told him that he could be fined if we lit up those helmets, Lindy pulled out his wad and asked, "How much?" In another city, the fire marshals required our roadies to wear firemen's outfits, complete with helmets, when they lit us up. Mark Johnson, our tour manager, was, in some ways, the original Homer Simpson. So just imagine Homer with a full fire-retardant outfit trying to get it together, turn the right knobs, and light the fire. It's amazing we got through that tour alive. In September 1992, we played the MTV Awards show and picked up two awards for the Give It Away video and the Viewer's Choice Award for Under the Bridge. It must have been awkward for Eric to be on stage accepting awards for work that John had done. We were full of ourselves and obnoxious and loud that night. When we went up to get the Breakthrough Video Award for Give It Away, Flea simulated masturbation. I had a list of 30 people I wanted to thank. Artists, musicians, filmmakers, scholars, and Satan. Back in Florida, my grandmother, who was a devout Christian, didn't realize I was joking around and disowned me. A little while later, I asked my mom why I never got any letters anymore from Grandma Ketis, and she said, "She thinks you're in league with Satan." I had to write Granny a postcard on her 80th birthday, explaining that I wasn't really a Satanist. That fall, we traveled to Australia and New Zealand to make up the dates we had canceled. Even though we weren't on an arena level yet, since this was the first time we'd ever played there, the audiences were amazingly responsive. As soon as we set foot in New Zealand, I fell in love with the place. It seemed like a home away from home. There was more plant life than I had ever seen, and towering, majestic mountains, and very few people. After our shows, everyone raced back home, but I decided to stay and explore the country. I got a room in a cool Art Deco hotel in downtown Auckland and hung out with Greer, who was a native Kiwi. One night we were playing pool when a long-haired brunette goddess out of a Kiwi fairy tale walked into the room. She stood at the bar and watched me, and I got up the courage to approach her. "What are you doing here?" I said, since she was out of place in the seedy bar.
"I came to find you," she explained. "I heard you were in town, and I've come to get you."
Julie got me, all right. We spent the rest of my stay together. We took a trip to the Rotorua and checked out the giant hot mineral lakes and the mud pits. We broke into a national park and made love at the edge of a mud pit that was a big bubbling cauldron of steam and mud. On November 1st, we celebrated my 30th birthday at the seaside home of Mr. and Mrs. Murdoch, who owned Warner Brothers Records in New Zealand. They organized a beautiful picnic on the beach for me. It was a bittersweet milestone. I was far from home, surrounded by relative strangers. The band was doing great, but it also was not right. Ever since John left, we had kept forging on without stopping to look at the lack of perfection, just moving forward to try to keep it alive. I was also lonely without a true love in my life. A lot of my close friendships had unraveled. John was out of the picture. Flea and I had been growing apart. Bob Forrest was deep into the exploration of his own drug abuse. I felt like a man alone. With nothing compelling me to return home, I decided to go on an adventure to Borneo. Even as a kid, I was always reading about the most remote tropical jungle locations in the world. And of all the places I'd ever read about, from Mongolia to Papua New Guinea to Tuva, Borneo always struck me as the most remote, the least westernized, a place where you could go back in time and see what life was like before industry and creature comforts. On our visits to Amsterdam, I had befriended an amazing tattoo artist named Hank Schiffmacher. Hank, also known as Hanky Panky, was an icon of his country, an underground philosopher, artist, Hell's Angels associate, booze hound, drug hound, girl hound, an absolute rapscallion of Dutch proportions. Over the years, Hank had injected much ink into my skin, and in the process, we'd become close. So when Hank suggested that we travel to Borneo to search out primitive tattooing techniques and replicate the crossing of the Borneo rainforest by a 19th century Dutch explorer, I was all for it. I had visions of being Mowgli from the Jungle Book,
hanging out with the orangutans and swinging from vines over rivers and eating berries and meeting naked native girls and being a tough nature fella. It didn't turn out quite that way. We put aside a month for the trip. At first, I thought it would be Hank and me traveling to the land of the Punandaya tribe, who had practiced cannibalism, according to some reports, as late as the 1960s. But Hank brought a photojournalist who thought getting his pictures was more important than the humanity or the dignity of the foreign culture. Hank also brought a Casper Milquetoast of a kid who had wandered into his tattoo shop, a bank employee who had never been outside of Holland. So we were a motley crew when we met up in Jakarta, Indonesia, to plan out our journey. I didn't like Jakarta, a third-world megalopolis saturated with trash and pollution and teeming with a fundamentalist energy that didn't make us feel the most welcome guys in town. We were a long way from Kansas, but every time we went to a bazaar or a marketplace, in every shanty town, I'd be surrounded by giggling Indonesian girls. They were selling bootleg Red Hot Chili Peppers t-shirts in every stall. It was surreal. From Jakarta, we took a series of small planes to Pontianak, a town on the west coast of Borneo. That was where we'd start our adventure. We planned to cross the central Borneo from Pontianak to Samarinda, the Trans-Kalimantan Tour. It had taken the Dutch ethnographer Nieuwenhuy 15 months to make this trip in 1894. We gave ourselves 4 weeks. We stayed in Pontianak for a day, stocking up on supplies and cigarettes. Then we got on the ferry barge and made our way up the river toward the center of the island. The river started off huge, like the Mississippi, and then kept getting smaller and smaller as we went deeper into the jungle, until it became these raging rapids-type rivers that were capable of quadrupling in size in about 10 minutes during flash floods. Everyone was in fantastic spirits, viewing this beautiful confluence of two rivers, until we saw miles and miles of decimated jungle. The logging industries had infiltrated this ancient civilization and raped the forest. It was as if an area the size of Rhode Island had been shaved clean off the map. After changing to a smaller boat, we reached the fishing village of Putusabau, the last outpost before we were confronted with true wilderness. Putusabau consisted of two main streets, one transvestite, and a Dutch missionary priest who almost gleefully warned us of the dangers that lay ahead, things like malaria and poisonous snakes. According to him, all the anti-malaria pills we'd been taking were completely useless, and if we ended up catching malaria, we were dead meat. Nice. The next day, we set off in our own boat. We stopped off after a few hours to explore an authentic longhouse, which was a jungle version of an apartment complex, except it was a commune where everybody lived together, sharing one common porch. Then we went on and on and on, deeper into the jungle. The farther up we got, the faster the water moved, the fewer the villages, and the more difficult passage became in general. Then the rains came. After changing to smaller and smaller boats, we made it to Tongjong Lakum, the last village before the terrain became too mountainous and too perilous to travel by boat. It was a serene setting before the maze of the jungle, where there was no river or even a path to follow, just an overlap of mountains, forests, and streams. It was here that we'd hire our guides from the Punans, a nomadic tribe considered the masters of the forests. The local Punans could probably cross the mountains in 5 days, but there was no telling how long it would take when they were bogged down with 4 slow white guys. I was uneasy with the guides they were choosing for us, because one was the grandpa of the village, a guy in his 70s, and the others were barely teenagers. I couldn't figure out if we were getting worthy guides or whichever nomads happened to be in town. We had a nice day or two of rest in the village, and then we set off on foot. It was a wild landscape, like nothing I'd ever marched through. The density, the heat, the wetness, the noises, all of it evoked a prehistoric feeling, especially when we spotted the giant horn-billed birds flying overhead. This was a different reality. After a day of hiking, we had come to terms with the fact that there were no paths to follow. It was just wet and mucky terrain. When nightfall came, we needed to find a dry, level space protected from the inevitable rains. We stumbled upon an old, decrepit outpost shack, so instead of building a lean-to out of huge leaves, our guides told us to stay in the shack. It didn't look inviting. The structure was teeming with insects and covered in spider webs, but we lay down in there like sardines, crawled into our sleeping bags, and tried to sleep. I was starting to doze off, half-conscious of the spiders dangling over me, when all of a sudden, my entire skull started to vibrate.
It felt like a woodpecker practicing on my skull. I was terrified that I'd been bitten by something poisonous and the toxic venom was going to work on my nervous system, so I bolted up and screamed for Hank to help me. The horrible vibrating noise in my skull was intensifying, and I couldn't bear one more minute of this agony, so I begged Hank to take out his flashlight and look inside my ear.
No, I don't see anything. Everything looks...
Ah! He screamed and dropped the flashlight. A huge sense of relief came over me, and my head stopped vibrating.
Oh my God, Hank said. Some little animal came scurrying out of your head, man.
It turned out that a cockroach had somehow squeezed into my ear canal and gotten lodged there. It took the light to get it to depart my head. I was glad to be rid of the roach. But then I started worrying that the monster had laid eggs inside my head and my brain would become dinner for a family of insects. But after a while, that obsession left me, probably because I was too busy dealing with the leeches that had begun to burrow into my body. Because the jungle was so dense, we sought out the rivers, which were anywhere from knee to waist deep. While you were in the water, these leeches would swim up and attach themselves to your skin. They'd suck your blood and become enormous, and every day we'd have to burn them off with a lit Marlboro. Then we'd be left with gaping open wounds, which could get infected. If you didn't pick up leeches in the river, they'd also be in the trees, waiting for you to walk under, so they were coming at us from all angles. About 5 days into the trek, we had our first major crisis. Our guides realized that we were totally lost, and they began to have powwows to figure out what to do. No one had any idea which direction to go. Our food was running out, and I got the distinct impression that they were looking at us like, let's ditch them, or kill them, or just eat them. But I think the grandpa nixed those stirrings, and we all set out to try to find our bearings. Then the sickness began. I started having severe nausea and diarrhea and vomiting, though I had no choice but to march tens of miles every day, straight up mountains and cliffs, carrying this heavy backpack. I couldn't sleep. All night long I'd flame diarrhea and simultaneously vomit. I began to hallucinate from dehydration and lack of food and sleep, but I became fixated on survival and willed my body onward. We started splitting up, sending out groups to climb to the top of the mountains and figure out where the mighty Mahakam River began. Once we found that, we would be home free. One day I went off with a guide and climbed to the top of the nearby mountain. The only way back down was a sheer vertical drop, which was, thankfully, covered with vines. I followed him step by step down the cliff, holding on to the vines. We came to a spot where there were no footholds, so now we were dependent on vine power alone to get us down. He scaled this 10-foot traverse, clinging to the vines, but when it was my turn, I questioned whether the vines would hold my weight. He assured me it was okay. I was still dubious. The minute I let go of the cliff and put my weight on the vines, the vine ripped loose from the cliff, and I went falling over backward. Now there was nothing to save me from plummeting to a certain death on the ragged rocks hundreds of feet below, except for the fact that on the way down, my foot had gotten tangled up in another series of vines. I was dangling upside down off of this cliff. My guide was safe above me, laughing hysterically. I had to claw myself to an upright position and untangle myself before I could reach a safe spot. Days later, we came upon the Mahakam, this fat, mountainous river with deep, blue, fast, treacherous water. We were still a few hundred miles from the ocean, but now it was a doable trip by boat, which we could hire at the first village, about 20 miles downriver. We were celebrating on that bank, kissing the ground, when we spied some locals in a boat. They had a whole deer, and our guides cajoled them into giving us a leg of the deer and a turtle. I had been a vegetarian for years, but I had no compunction about tearing into that poorly cooked venison. Before the natives departed, our guides ordered a boat to come get us the next day. Then the dreaded rains came. We were in a canyon, and there was no shoreline, just sheer rocks, and the river rose and spilled over our campsite. We were forced up this steep slope that had some vegetation and a few trees, and we had to spend the night standing up against the mountain, resting our feet on some tree stumps below. The next day, the boat showed up, and we made a deal for passage to the ocean and said goodbye to our guides, who turned around and scurried back over the mountains to their village. That night we stopped at a village and managed to rent a room, but my fever returned with a vengeance. Again, I was up all night, spewing out of both ends, feeling weaker than I ever had in my entire life. My condition wasn't helped when we got the news that a few days earlier, a team of Australians doing the same trek had died in a flash flood. The next day, I was so sick and so desperate to get back to civilization that I went to the local communications base, got on the shortwave, and ordered a helicopter to come get us. Hank and I were choppered to Balik, where I found a doctor who prescribed some antibiotics, which seemed to take the edge off my illness without curing it. Then I hugged Hank goodbye. Our bond had been strengthened by our conquest over death by making it through that damn jungle. On the way back to L.A., I stopped in New Zealand, but I still wasn't feeling normal. A few days later, when I got on the flight to L.A., I sat down and nearly passed out. Buckets of sweat started pouring out of me, my fever escalated, and I started hallucinating again. When we landed, I could barely get off the plane. After spending a day on my couch, I checked into the UCLA Medical Center, where they were baffled by my condition. They gave me some painkillers, which I was willing to take even though I was sober. I went back home, but now I was going into feverish painkiller sweat baths. I checked into Cedars-Sinai, where, after days and days of testing, they determined that I had a rare tropical disease called dengue fever. Well, at least now I knew what I had, and the treatment course was the same potent antibiotics. I recovered, although we did have to cancel our New Year's Eve show in San Francisco. I was fine when we flew down to Brazil to perform some big shows in January. It was a four-night festival, and we were alternating nights with Nirvana, each band doing shows in Rio and São Paulo. We all flew down together in a big 747, and it was a real festive situation, but nothing could have prepared me for the reception we got in Brazil. Even though Nina Hagen had told me that after the rest of the world had forgotten her, she could go to Brazil and get a welcome like she was one of the Beatles, I still couldn't believe the fervor of the Brazilian fans. We needed members of the armed services to help us leave the hotel. The fans had an exuberance that bordered on being dangerous. The day before we were scheduled to play Rio, we got a police escort and were ferried deep into a favela, a slum neighborhood that even the police were afraid to enter, to see an authentic Mardi Gras samba troupe practice. We were so knocked out by this South American Mother Earth soul music and pageantry that we invited the whole troupe to come on stage and jam with us the next night. And they did. At least twice as many members poured on stage as were at rehearsal, all decked out in their best costumes. Chad didn't know what to do, so he started to beat on his drums, and they started playing along, shaking their percussive sticks and dancing and singing. Flea found his groove and got in there, and Eric started playing something funky that worked. I had a hard time finding a place in that arrangement until two samba girls came over and started dancing with me, and then we all danced and percussed and had a rad psychedelic jam. Nirvana was headlining the next night, and we were all excited about their show. Meanwhile, Courtney Love was making an unbelievable spectacle of herself every chance she possibly could. I had never seen anyone so designed for attention and spotlight and drama. She was out of control. Whenever a photographer aimed his camera at a group of people, Courtney flew into the frame, grabbing everyone like she was their best friend. We didn't see much of Kurt, who was very reclusive. I spent some time with him backstage before his second show. He was high on pills, which somehow never affected his performance, and he was quiet and withdrawn. But he had such mad style, wearing the best combination of colors and sweaters and mismatched stuff. Nirvana just killed both nights. They played a lot of new songs that would turn up on In Utero, and then they all switched their instruments and went into some 70s pop songs like Seasons in the Sun. During one of the two shows, Kurt took this insane guitar solo that lasted 10 minutes. He took off his guitar and started playing it while it was on the ground, and then he bashed it into his amp. He wound up in the audience playing the destroyed guitar. When he went back on stage and the crowd started fighting over the guitar, Courtney came flying out of the wings, dove into the audience, and beat up a few Brazilian kids to take possession of the guitar. She climbed back on stage and proudly held up the mangled guitar, strutting around and milking every minute. She finally went off stage, and somehow Louis, our crew member, wound up with the neck of that guitar, which he still has to this day. We flew back home, happy to have shared those experiences with Nirvana. Everybody loved that band. Meanwhile, the Blood Sugar album was still rolling along. I still wasn't used to any of the extra public awareness. I remember going to a party for Lisa Marie Presley in an airplane hangar in Santa Monica around this time. I went to the bathroom to take a piss, and this normal-looking businessman in a suit walked up to the urinal next to me, looked over, and recognized me. "Oh my God, you're that guy," he said, and started howling a version of Under the Bridge. Another time I was riding my mountain bike by my house, and a random car drove by, and I heard Under the Bridge blaring out the window. I realized that our music was now in the public domain, and no longer some underground phenomenon, which made me a bit more shy and reclusive. Ironically, Flea and I had spent most of our lives craving attention and trying to create a spectacle, doing outlandish things to be seen and heard and felt. One time back at Fairfax High, we found out that the corner of Westwood and Wilshire Boulevard was the busiest intersection in the world, so we drank a bit and split a Quaalude and went down to that corner, shimmied up a pole, and climbed onto an enormous billboard that looked down on that busy intersection. We stripped naked and danced around, swinging our dicks for every passerby to see. It felt like the whole world was watching, and that felt good. A memorable moment when we could be exhibitionists and performers and daredevils and junior lawbreakers all at the same time. Now we were on those billboards instead of dancing naked in front of them. So I didn't feel the compulsion to fight for attention or brag about how amazing our music was anymore. Now it was time to create more of it. Flea and I had both started to write, and we were looking forward to bonding with Eric and exploring his mind and musical talents. After we finished touring, Eric rented a nice apartment close to my house. But every time I tried to get together to work with him, he wasn't available. I wound up going over to his house and dropping off some lyrics and a half-baked tape because he didn't seem comfortable getting out the guitar at that moment. But again, there was no response. No callback. No, "I've got some ideas." It wasn't long after that we decided he might not be the writing partner we were looking for. That was when we got the most god-awful idea, which was to advertise and audition guitar players. We thought we could audition every guitar player in the world and find the most perfect, talented, soulful, and fun player around, but it doesn't work that way. It's like finding a wife. You have to hope she crosses your path. We put an ad in the LA Weekly and held auditions. It was a circus, and it went nowhere. Some people could play, but some kids came by hoping to meet the band. Around that time, I had seen a band called Mother Tongue at Club Lingerie, and I liked their guitar player, a kid named Jesse Tobias. I told Flea about him, and we decided to bring him in. We jammed, and it was very raw and energetic. He definitely had the most exciting chemistry of anyone we had played with, but Flea was mildly concerned that he might not have the technical range required to play our music. In the end, we hired him, and he quit his band, and we began to play and write music. After a couple of weeks, something wasn't right. We jammed and jammed with Jesse, but no one was satisfied, particularly Flea. I was still holding out hope that it would work when Chad came to me and said, "I have a feeling that Dave Navarro is ready to play with us." Dave had always been our first choice after John left. We had approached him early on, but he'd been too busy with his side project after Jane's addiction broke up. Lately, Chad had been hanging around with him, and he was sure Dave would love to come over. It was the ideal situation, because when Dave was in Jane's addiction, they had virtually invented a sound and shared a spirit of music that was unique and enormously emotional and was the voice of LA for a long time. It was passionate, original art coming from all the right places, with all the right insanity and love. So we fired Jesse and hired Dave. Navarro had the best line. He told us, "I heard a rumor out on the street that the reason you fired Jesse was because he was too cute and was stealing some of the female attention away from you. And then you hire me. What does that say for me?" He had the most sardonic sense of humor. When he first joined the band, he made up guitar picks that listed each guitarist we'd ever had in the band. After his name, there was a question mark. With Dave in the band, it was inevitable that our sound would change. He had a different style of playing than anyone we'd had before, but he was very competent and quick to learn our songs. He didn't carry with him the mysterious essence of funk, but we weren't stressed about that. We were prepared to explore other territory. I couldn't have predicted his incredible kindness. He was a very sensitive, tender, there-for-you person, right off the bat, which was wonderful in combination with his sardonic wit. Despite all this, we got off to a strange beginning, because not everyone adjusted right away to our dynamic. John had been a true anomaly when it came to that. He made it even easier than Hillel in some ways to create music, even though I'd known Hillel for years. I just figured that was how all guitar players were, that you showed them your lyrics and sang a little bit, and the next thing you knew, you had a song. That didn't happen right off the bat with Dave. I remember going over to Dave's house, and he and I wanted to learn a Beatles song together, and it was a much slower, more difficult process than in the past. We all liked Dave, but unbeknownst to me, he was feeling like an outsider. I don't think he knew how open we were to making him an equal partner. He had been through a lot of battles with Perry Farrell and Jane's Addiction, and their writing styles were independent, so he wasn't used to our collaborative style. It wasn't until years later that he told me he was concerned he would get fired any minute. At the end of October 1993, I decided to take a short trip to New York to both celebrate my birthday and accompany my good friend Guy O'Siri of Maverick Records to all the festivities surrounding Fashion Week. Guy was hot on the trail of Kate Moss, and I had no aversion to hanging out with him and going to runway shows. We stayed at the Royalton and got in late from a Halloween party. A few hours into my sleep, the phone started ringing off the hook. I picked up the receiver, and it was my dad. He was in a frenzied state, babbling, "Did you hear what happened? River's dead." I was half awake at the time, so it took a few seconds for me to process the information. After I did, I called him right back, and he told me that River Phoenix had died the previous night outside a club in L.A. of a drug overdose. Once again, I felt an unbelievable sense of loss. I called up Flea, who had accompanied River in the ambulance from the Viper Room to the hospital, and we both sobbed for quite some time. River wasn't my best friend, but he was a completely enchanted spirit of a human, living every day in a very free way. It was my birthday, but I didn't feel like celebrating. I spent some of the day with my friend Acacia, who had been the girlfriend of both Flea and Joaquin, River's brother. I went to her apartment in Chinatown, and we lay in her bunk bed together, sobbing. I was feeling gutted and hollowed out. I made my way back to the Royalton, and Guy O forced me to let him take me out for a birthday dinner. As is Guy O's wont, we went to the trendy, goofy restaurant of the moment. We ate and played some pool, and then Guy dragged me to a place called the Soul Kitchen. There was a great DJ that night, and at one point, I got up and tried to dance my blues away. When I got back to our table, there was a cluster of humans around Guy, including two hot, model-looking girls who were doing the typical things young model girls do, drinking alcohol and smoking Marlboros. I couldn't take my eyes off one of them, this glowing pixie with a butch haircut, especially when she started making out with her girlfriend. I could tell that they weren't girlfriends. They were just kissing for entertainment purposes. We didn't have much of an exchange that night, but she did tell me that she would be in the Calvin Klein show the next day. By now, my crosshairs were fixed on this girl. I'd been touched by something about her, and it wasn't simply a random biological reaction to a gorgeous girl I wanted to sleep with. There was a more metaphysical feeling about her and our possibilities. I told Gaio about my attraction, and he poo-pooed it, telling me to keep my options open. Then we went to the Klein show the next day, and there was that hot blonde's picture on the cover of the Daily W newspaper for the fashion show. All at once, Gaio took a lot more interest in her. We watched her walk, and I was smitten by Cupid's arrow. I have an overwhelming tendency to get ahead of myself in these matters, so if I see a girl I like, even if I've never talked to her, I'll sit there and look at her and go, "Now I could marry that girl. She looks like she'd be a good mom and a good sex partner." I was convinced that the young Jamie Rashar would be thinking the same way, and she'd be my girl. That night, we all met at Indochine, a trendy downtown restaurant, but the interaction was nothing like I had imagined. She was sitting there with a table full of hens, quacking away, all models, all drinking way too much, smoking way too much, and taking what they do way too seriously. I showed up with Guy O, expecting her to make herself available to me, but she was being aloof, intentionally distant, and intentionally shit-faced. I was patient and tolerant. Christy Turlington started talking to Jamie and filling her head with negative information about me. "Stay away from that guy. He's a womanizer. He's a slut. He'll love you and leave you. Blah, blah, blah." I started to lose some of my interest in Jamie, thinking she was too young and too wrapped up in the nonsense of her micro-community. But something in me wasn't going to give up all the way, and at a certain point, I could see that she needed to go home and be in bed.
So I put her in a cab, and she asked me to go home with her. So I went, and we slept together that night, but nothing happened because she was too full of booze to start our romance off. The next night, we had an out-of-control, over-the-top sexual encounter. She rocked me in a way I hadn't thought possible by a person of her age. 17. There was some very adult behavior taking place, and I remember going, "Wow, what fucking porno has this girl been watching?" I went back to LA, and we were on the phone every night. The first night we were talking, she said, "I have a small problem. I'm seeing this guy, and I have to let him know that it's over between us." Turned out he was a trust fund baby whose dad was a Wall Street gazillionaire. She said the other problem was that her parents had gotten wind of our relationship, and they weren't having any of it. Her dad started leaving threatening messages on my answering machine, especially after her jilted boyfriend told him I had AIDS. But Jamie was undaunted, and we started plotting and scheming to get her out to LA for a visit. I called her dad and convinced him that, one, I didn't have AIDS, and two, I wasn't an ogre. I also sweet-talked her mom, and they let her come out for a visit. I don't remember too much about her first trip, other than going to pick her up and watching her walk out of her hotel room wearing some go-go boots. I thought, whoa, this is definitely where I want to be. We had a lot of fun and were at ease with each other right away. That Christmas, we made the obligatory trip to Michigan, and she bonded with my mom right away. To this day, they speak to each other every day. Then we flew to Pennsylvania, and I met her parents. I was nervous, but it was actually pretty mellow. I got along with her mom right away. She was sweet and loving, the classic mom. I didn't have any real problems with Dad. It turned out that he was the true music lover in the household. He had these stacks and stacks of doo-wop stuff and R&B 45s, and he would start playing them, and Jamie and he would sing along and do dances in the kitchen. In January 1994, I was 5.5 years sober, with no intention or desire to ever take drugs again. Then I went to a Beverly Hills dentist to have a wisdom tooth removed. I had been to see many doctors and many dentists during that 5.5 years, and I had this canned speech that I gave them. "I'm allergic to narcotics. Whatever you have to do to me, you'll have to do it with local anesthetics or some non-narcotic substance." The dentist thought he could do the operation with a local, so I got in the chair and got jacked up on Novocaine. He started to extract the tooth, but in the middle of the process, he told me it was so badly impacted that he'd have to cut it out of my mouth. In order to do that, he'd have to put me under. I'd already been in the chair for an hour, so I agreed. So he stuck an IV in my arm and shot me up with liquid Valium. That stuff ran up my arm, up my throat, and into my head, and a golden cloud of euphoria came over me. It was the first time I'd felt that loaded in 5.5 years. It felt so good, and I was so under the influence that I was no longer me. I was now the stoned, under-the-influence guy. The dentist got the tooth out, and I was feeling warm and cozy and fine, floating on this cloud, and also becoming aware of this new voice in my head that said, "We've got to keep this up right away. We're not letting this feeling go away." And I was like, "Don't worry, we're on the same team here, brother." As soon as the dentist was finished, he asked me if I was in pain, and I told him I was hurting so bad I needed some Percodin. He looked confused, but I insisted that all that previous allergic talk was nonsense, and I needed those Percodins right away. I ate a handful of the 25 pills before I even left the building, and shortly after I got home, there were only 2 left in the bottle. Now I had a proper opium buzz going. Right at that moment, I decided it would be a good idea to drive to downtown LA and buy some heroin and cocaine. I didn't think twice about it. I didn't think about my sobriety or where I'd come from. I was strictly in the moment of being high and wanting to get higher. No consciousness of any consequences, and nothing. Zilch. So I drove to my old spot, Bonnie Brea and 6th, and I found out that those packages of nice cocaine had been supplanted by the crack cocaine trade. All I could get was rocks. But the good old-fashioned black tar heroin was exactly the same, and I knew what to do with that. I went into a drugstore to get some needles and pulled my usual diabetic scam, but I forgot that now I was recognizable. The pharmacist looked at me and said, "Oh, Mr. Kiedis, I didn't know you were a diabetic." I said, "Yep, diabetic, that's me."
On the way back home, I stopped at a pipe shop on Sunset Boulevard and bought this big, goofy pipe for freebasing. They recognized me there, too, but I pretended it was a gag gift for a party. I went home, and I didn't have a lighter, so I tried to light the crack with matches, which was a horrible idea, because the match doesn't stay lit long enough to get the rock going. This went on for a couple of days, and then I made another trip downtown and found